KCAA Loma Linda. Listen on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM.
You've now entered into the House of Mystery radio show with Al Warren and Mike Brown.
Hello.
So, here we go. Now, today we are going to be talking about the Swiss Air crash off of
Nova Scotia. Yeah, Peggy's Cove.
Yeah, and so we'll have Thomas Juby on, and he's the sergeant or ex-sergeant from RCMP that led the criminal investigation into that.
A really different take on everything around Swiss Air from him. Just a different look at the investigation, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of curious. I'm kind of on the fence with him, and not with him personally, but with his theory, I should say. I don't know.
It's fascinating, though. It's one to think about.
Yeah, it's always good. It's always good to talk, think about it, try to work things out logically, and I think that's great. We'll have him on. We'll talk about that. We have RCMP officer, ex-RCMP, and he wrote a book called Twice as Far. It's Tom Juby, so he's sitting on the line right now. How are you today?
I'm doing well. It's nice and warm here, and the sun is shining, and it's great.
So for people that don't know anything about you and about the crash, before we get into that, who are you in the sense of what did you do before you wrote the book, and how did you get into this Swiss Air flight? Like, what was your involvement?
I was 32 years in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. I was a forensic crime scene investigator, the CSI that you see on TV. I started doing that in 1975. So at the time of Swiss Air, I had 27 years of doing it. In 1998, I was working in Halifax, and on September 2nd, of 98, MD-11 aircraft owned and operated by Swiss Air crashed into the ocean off Halifax, Nova Scotia, and 229 people perished.
I remember that very well myself. I was back there with my wife. She and I were on honeymoon in PEI at the time.
Yeah, that was, any air crash is a major event when it's like that. An air crash in North America is always a very major event when there's humongous loss of life, and this was a major tragedy. There were some very prominent people on board, and of the 229 people who perished, more than 100 were American citizens, and it was called the UN shuttle because it was flying from New York, JFK, New York, to Geneva, Switzerland, and there were a lot of UN people on board, and again, like I say, some very major and prominent people, and It was tragic. It went in at about 10:30 in the evening, and they did a search and rescue all night long, and by morning they knew that there were no survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And over the next 2 months, we operated a morgue. The plane, when it struck the ocean, it was... surface of the water, it was doing better than 350 miles an hour, and it broke into shards well over. The Transportation Safety Board said 1 million pieces.
Mm.
I think they lost count, and there were several million pieces of that aircraft. And it took more than a year to pull it all off the ocean, off the ocean floor.
Wow.
From the get-go, we knew that there had been a fire on board, a major fire, and it was to such a point that the crew had decided to do an emergency landing at Halifax, and they didn't make it, obviously, and the fire incapacitated the aircraft so that it could no longer fly, and I believe that everyone was dead prior to impact. An aircraft is similar to a submarine in that it's a very confined space and controlled air. And you had a major fire with lots of plastics burning, lots of cyanide, and that air is circulating through the cabin. Low oxygen and high cyanide results in death, and that's the root cause of most fire deaths. People don't die through burning up; they die through smoke inhalation. The plane was recovered in the several million pieces, and over the next 3.5 years, we worked to put those pieces back together to try to tell the story. Now, the Transportation Safety Board of Canada, similar to the NTSB in the U.S., had control of the file, and there was an agreement with the RCMP that we would supply technical assistance in the way of photography, physical evidence, handling, processing, and certain types of analysis and lab work, that type of thing. And being in Forensic Ident, that was largely my area. And within a year, I was the only Forensic Ident member on the file.
Mm-hmm.
During the course of the file, I took probably 150 or close to 200,000 photos. There was thousands of exhibits taken and analysis of all types. Again, as I say, there was a fire, and we knew that the plane had gone in because it had lost control due to the fire, but what had caused the fire?
That was right.
The main question. So it came down to a case of trying to search for that cause. Initially, and the media played a major part in this, I think, and I have my comments about the input of media. Because right away, the armchair guys who knew all about plane crashes said that it was the in-flight entertainment system that had caused the fire. Well, it turns out that the in-flight entertainment system on the Swiss Air airplanes was a unique system. And when they did a history check of it with the Swiss Air company, the technicians, they were flying 19 of these aircraft, all of which had this entertainment system. They had never had a problem with any of them while in flight. The TSB looked at the system and said that they didn't like the way it had been wired, in that it was wired directly into the fuse box and didn't go through a certain control panel. And that was a bone of contention from the get-go, but really, in the overall investigation, it had very little to play in the cause of the fire. One of the arguments that I made that the entertainment system didn't cause the fire was, or that they hadn't had problems with the entertainment system on any of the flights, was the pilots did not realize that the entertainment system was not controlled through this alternate panel that they control all of their electrical stuff with. Well, if you're a pilot and have a problem with the system and learn that, you're going to tell every other pilot in your organization, and none of them knew. So, you know, the argument is, I don't think that the entertainment system was a problem at all, period. So we realized, during the investigation, we realized that there were several dozen short-circuited wires. There's 250 miles of wiring on an MD-11, and during the fire, we had numerous short-circuited wires. So they came up with an old physics law and a new system of examination so as to look into the short-circuited wire to determine a timeline, is the best way to put it, a timeline for the cause of that short circuit. Basically, what it is there's an old physics law called Siewert's law, and he argued, and this goes back hundreds of years, he argued that a liquid absorbs the atmosphere around it in direct proportion to the temperature of that liquid. When a wire short circuits, it's at many thousands of degrees Fahrenheit, and it's a liquid, and it literally sucks up the atmosphere around it. And it's only for an instant, and then it freezes, becomes a solid, and it traps that air inside the subsurface area of that bead with a very specialized system called Auger electron spectroscopy. You can tap into that bead and determine what those air molecules were. The beads on the aircraft were pure copper, 99.9% pure copper, with a tin or nickel coating. And what we found in the testing was a high concentration of magnesium, aluminum, and iron. Now, those three ingredients are the ingredients of a thermite device, an incendiary device.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of this testing was actually done at the Boeing lab preparation for the testing was done at the Boeing lab in Seattle. And it turns out that the Seattle Fire Department inadvertently plays quite a part in this story in my book, because in years past, prior to the crash, they had investigated some very serious fires during which buildings with very little in them in the way of fire load burnt to the ground in very short time periods.
Mm-hmm.
They did analysis of it along with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and determined that there was an accelerant used, and it included magnesium and aluminum. An accelerant with diesel fuel, magnesium, and aluminum. They gave it the name rocket fuel because your space shuttle with the boosters on the side of it wouldn't get off the ground unless they mixed magnesium and aluminum powder in the solid petroleum propellant. That gave it the extra heat and boost to get it into the air. And during the fires that Seattle was looking at, it was causing concrete buildings to disintegrate.
Mm.
And they called it rocket fuel, or HTA, high temperature accelerant. And it turns out that on this aircraft, we had magnesium and aluminum, along with iron, that we couldn't account for. And that became a serious bone of contention. The doctor who was doing the analysis was in Ottawa, and he was considered to be one of the best in the world. He was a leader in North America in the process, and he lectured around the world. He'd been doing it for 20-odd years, and he was a PhD in geology, and he knew his stuff.
Mm.
However, the Transportation Safety Board and senior members of the RCMP, with no knowledge of geology and certainly no knowledge of Auger electron spectroscopy, decided that he didn't know what he was talking about.
Mm.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, and there's a question that I cannot answer. All I know is the Transportation Safety Board was given the task of investigating the file as a safety file,
mm-hmm.
not as a criminal investigation. The TSB does not do criminal. They only do safety. I was told on numerous occasions to cease my criminal investigation that I was undertaking as a police officer. And that's what I do as a criminal investigation. I don't do anything else.
Right.
And I was told to stop. Eventually, I was brought in front of four other senior members, and I was handed a piece of paper, and on it were instructions that I was required to sign, indicating that I would alter my notes. I would edit my notes. That stuff pertained to the criminal investigation that I was conducting and the potential cause of the fire as an incendiary device. Now, there's a couple of other things to keep in mind. We had the guys, when they went to JFK, one of the first things that is done in an air crash investigation is to interview all the people who had previously worked on the aircraft. When it's at the airport, you have aircraft technicians who might be there to service various parts of the plane, but you have a cleaning staff, you have a catering staff, and you have various other people who work that airplane. And they interviewed all but one. One person at JFK Airport worked the one shift, worked on that plane, and was never seen again. They don't know who he was because he gave false identification. And this is in 1998. We still to this day don't know who he was. Now, you know, where the fire was, where it was situated in the cabin, anyone with limited instructions would be able to access that area and deposit whatever they may have deposited. And it would have only have taken a pair of coveralls, a stepladder, and a few seconds.
I've got a question for you here, Tom. Can you speak a little bit about what the motive might have been for this kind of situation? We know that I believe the plane was called, or that particular flight was called the UN shuttle.
One of the other things that is normally done on the airplane on a crash is to find out who the people were that were on board. We knew name, birth date, address, but Fred Jones, who actually was he? Who was he working for? Why was he on the plane? Why was he going to Geneva? Where was he going beyond? Was he meeting up with someone, or, you know, what about him? What did he have any enemies? Our guys who were doing that, and it's called profiling, our guys who were doing that, by day three, were told to shut down. We don't want it done. We only know a couple of people who were on board, their histories and whatnot. And of those people, you know, they're very prominent people, and they could have been targets. There was one guy who was supposed to be on board, and that was an MI6 agent who was supposed to be on board, but the U.S. authorities at JFK put him on an earlier flight and got him out of the country at the request of the British authorities. When he learned that the plane had crashed, he immediately went into hiding in Switzerland, and it was learned that MI6 had a contract on him.
Wow.
Richard Tomlinson is the name, and easily found on the web. There was $1 million on board. There was a Picasso worth well over $1 million. And there was over $1 billion worth of diamonds. We never recovered the diamonds. And we don't know if they were ever on board.
Yeah, this part is very interesting for me, too, because you recover over $1 million pieces of a plane, and then these things just don't ever show up, which is pretty fascinating. But I'm sure they were insured for the amount that they were worth.
I would imagine, yes. I, to tell you the truth, that was not part of my area, so I didn't follow it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing I have learned is that there is a possibility that they were recovered by the U.S. Navy, but it's only it's only a possibility. One of the ROV operators recovered a briefcase. And he had been told to locate it, and he did locate it and found it, retrieved it with his ROV. We don't know. It was never recorded, and we don't know whether it was the diamonds that were on board or whether it was a courier carrying diplomatic stuff. But the argument, I guess, is New York to Geneva, you've got the UN, but it's not an embassy. Like, it would be a Washington flight. You're going to Europe where your couriers would be carrying diplomatic stuff. Would they be on this flight? I don't know. And that's something that, you know, maybe someone... obviously someone with more knowledge than me would know.
Apparently a number of them were UN employees. So
but would they have a briefcase handcuffed to their arm?
Right. Yeah, we don't know that.
And that's where the passenger profiling comes in. Why were we told, or our guys told, not to profile the passengers? Not to find out who they were. The guy who serviced the plane and was never found again, the U.S. authorities at the airport made the comment, oh, that's not unusual. We often have, at that time, we often have employees who only work the one shift, and we don't really know who they are. My argument to my guys was, and how many planes crash within an hour of those guys working on them? An opportune time for someone to put an incendiary device on. Now, was it there to cover a theft, or was it there to take out someone?
How was it with the other RCMP people you worked with and the other officers and stuff? Did you have anybody else that was sort of supportive in what you were doing or thinking?
Yeah. One of the other guys, he'd gone to New York and met with the BATF people, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and they were going to come up to view the wreckage. And the BATF is considered to be some of the best fire examiners in the world. They're renowned for what they do. And when our boss found out that they were coming, or going to come up, he forbid their attendance. He ended up going to this member and telling him that he wanted his notes amended. He wanted them to change his notes. And then he booted him out of the hangar, kicked him out of the hangar and off the investigation. And he told him he was to have no further contact with me at all. Now, this guy, Carl, he had contacts with the BATF. The BATF knew about magnesium and aluminum and HTA, high temperature accelerant, rocket fuel. If they had come up, I obviously would have been speaking with them, would have told them about the high magnesium and aluminum and iron that we had, and somebody would have drawn joined the dots. And my bosses did not want that. Now, why, I don't know. But somewhere in there. And to tell a member to change his notes, to tell a police officer to change his notes and to destroy evidence like that. Notes are evidence. That's obstruction of justice. That is a serious criminal offense.
I'm trying to figure out the reasoning behind their movements. Like, you know, if there was some bomb or something to ignite the plane, to take down the plane for a particular reason, why are the upper brass in the RCMP and people like that trying to hold back that sort of investigation or discovery? Like, are they involved in the missing items? And I'm trying to connect them.
I know, and it's a quandary. I do not have the answers. All I know is there's a whole lot of things that point to the obstruction, and there's documents, and I have documents on my website. I have statements, like my notes, different comments by those officers. And statements by members of the TSB. When you put them all together, they form a series of dots, and they travel in a certain direction. And that direction goes all the way to the top, and it indicates that the top echelons were told to keep this as an accident. But back then, it was kind of, we don't want to tell the public, keep it quiet. It's like a faulty bridge. Well, it would cost too much to fix it. And hopefully, the right things or the wrong things won't occur at the wrong times and the bridge collapse. I have no doubt that the RCMP and the TSB were directed by the Prime Minister's office. 229 people who I believe were murdered, and it would have run out of the, it would have been run by the FBI in the U.S. with most of the expenses borne by the U.S. So why was it shut down here?
And how were the Americans toward that? Did they, did this not bother them?
I only saw two FBI agents, and they were up for the morgue facility, and they were fingerprint guys. And other than that, we never saw them. When it came time to meet with them down in the States, my boss and the crew that went down, they did meet with them, and there were discussions, and it was, I can only assume it was put forward that there was no physical evidence to indicate a incendiary device or a criminal device, and it was a safety investigation. And again, it was the in-flight entertainment system that was the cause.
You know, it, when we watch the different documentaries out there, there is one on, of course, the Fifth Estate, and then there's one on... National Geographic, and there's another one too. They talked about the insulation blankets being very flammable, but yet on your report, you're saying that you couldn't. It was too difficult to light them on fire.
We did tests at the FAA down in Atlantic City. And we set up a mock frame similar to the overhead area of the MD-11. And we put the blankets in, and we put in the air ducts and what have you. And we tried to melt aluminum. And we put the insulation blankets in, and we could just barely get the stuff to burn. We could not melt aluminum, and it was a slow fire. The stuff did burn, and everything is relative. If you don't want it to burn and it does burn, well, then it's highly flammable. But if you're trying to cook on your barbecue and you've only got the dregs of the tank, a propane tank, and it's only sputtering, well, it's not going to cook your barbecue, is it? But it still could cause a fire. It's the idea that we could not melt aluminum and do the damage that was done on our crashed aircraft. We did S until the very last burn. And what it was the intent was to put an equivalent amount in to the frame and have it burn all at once and see how much heat it generated. When later on, when I did the math, I found out they had put in more than six times the amount. Mm. And it melted aluminum, all right. The frame cracked and there was all kinds of molten aluminum, but it was six times the amount.
Mm.
And it was fluffed up. It was, if you burn a newspaper and roll it up as a log, your newspaper will last for hours. But if you take each page and crumple them up and throw them on the fire all at once, you'll have a raging inferno that just lasts a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Same material, but its physical properties are different because the amount of air that's involved and how it's situated. And that's the thing on the airplane. when the blankets are in place and there's multi-layers and you have moisture from condensation, they're hard to burn.
What kind of response are you getting on your theory and the book?
When I put it forward to the CBC back in 2010 and 11, and Lyndon McIntyre looked at the thing, he was absolutely astounded. In fact, he was interviewed just a year ago by a local paper down here, and his comment was, the one program that he had, he retired, of course, in all of his years with the Fifth Estate, the one topic that he had a real problem with in that it wasn't resolved was Swiss Air. That there was a problem in the investigation, and he could never understand why it was dealt with the way it was dealt with, that there was evidence that was denied.
What do you hope people get from your book, and where do you want it to go?
I would like to see an inquiry. I hope it's a public inquiry, and this is similar fact evidence. From the top down, said, yeah, it was okay for them to come to me and tell me to change my notes and to overlook that material. And that is wrong. That is illegal.
Yeah.
Those are serious. We're talking 10 and 14 years in jail for a sentence on those things. That's not just running a red light. Well, it's time for those officials to stand up and be dealt with, and to create an example of them, because in this, as far as I'm concerned, here's two cases that I know of where this one inspector hid evidence or you know, obstructed justice, and he retired, got a real good pension, and went on to a second job with now another pension, and oh yeah, he's just wonderful. Wait a minute, he's a criminal. As far as I'm concerned, he's a criminal. A guy did 17 years. 229 people were murdered. Nothing done about it. Boeing and the airline companies basically have not carried out most of the recommendations that came out of that crash. Why? Because they knew that the recommendations were bogus.
No, you have a website out there with the timeline and everything. Where can people go to find out information?
Twice as far, or swissair111.ca or .com. But twice as far, and all one word. And if you, or just query my name, Google my name, Tom Juby, J-U-B-Y, and it will come up. The website, when the initial program came out, I had a lot of people say, you don't know what you're talking about, and you're not an investigator, you're an ident guy, and ta-da, ta-da, ta-da. You don't know the whole story. So when I wrote the book, I realized I couldn't put all the information in the book, or it would be 1,000 pages. So I decided I'll create the website to put the documents in, and put the timeline, and copies of my notes, and this and that. And the documents are there, the form that I was given telling me to change my notes. It's there. The report that came back from the senior officer in Ottawa, an assistant commissioner of the RCMP, who said that it was quite all right for that officer to demand that I change my notes. That report is there. That links right the way up to the commissioner. They're complicit in the whole thing. It just, you know, it is an obstruction of justice to change your notes.
Has there been any threats on your life or anything like that?
I'm a big guy. So,
yeah.
And I'm a good shot. So I always used to say, if somebody's going to shoot me, they better be good on the first shot.
Yeah, get me good first.
You know, these I watch over my shoulder and yeah. and whatnot, but yeah, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I put out the book and in the website. Too late, guys. If you're gonna shut me up, it's too late. Hopefully, the right people will get hold of it, and we'll go somewhere. The only thing is, the problem is the politics.
Well. Our hour is quickly up, and on that note, we're going to have to cut it short. But we've been talking about Twice as Far and the author Thomas C. Juby. And thank you, Tom, for giving us some information.
Well, thank you very much. This hour has flown by.
It certainly has. Thank you, Tom.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or show, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.